New York Times journalist Damien Cave thought that running the Australian Bureau would be a chance to kick back compared to reporting from war zones. But he says Australia challenged him in ways he could never have imagined, changed his life, in fact. His new book is called Into the Rip, How the Australian Way of Risk Made My Family Stronger, Happier and Less American. Damien, big welcome to you to Life Matters today.
Thank you. I really appreciate you calling on me.
Well, we're going to drill down into this intriguing idea that, you know, there are these big differences between Australianness and Americanness in the ways we approach some of life's big challenges, looking at the Nippers tryouts in Bronte in a moment. But let's go back first a bit. When you heard there was a job going in Australia, tell us what your expectations were at that point.
Well, you know, at that point, I didn't know too much about Australia. My wife had come here and studied for a bit and was a big fan, obviously. But I kind of figured, well, it's probably like a little bit like California, but a lot further away. And I think a lot of Americans kind of make that mistake. I thought it would be laid back. And to a certain extent, it has been. But I didn't really anticipate the degree to which I would sort of be expected to participate and join this whole crazy thing called Australia. I kind of thought I would be able to just sit back as an observer, and Australia didn't allow me to do that.
That's really interesting, because a lot of us who consume American pop culture would say, well, there's the PTA, there's the baseball leagues, there's lots of opportunities, it looks like, for parents to be involved in their children's lives and community life. It seems to be represented as a very community-based society. Is that not the case?
Well, I think there are community-based organizations, but the idea that you would pressure someone to join something, I think Americans have a very hard time with. It's this respect for personal autonomy and individualism, and if you choose to do it, great. But I would never throw my arm around someone and say, oh, you've got to get involved in this Nippers thing, or oh, you've got to get involved in this Little League thing. It just isn't as much a part of the culture. And so I think that's a big difference.
Well, and the sausage sizzle sounds like it was quite a confronting time for you socially, as well as this kind of cultural difference.
Yeah, I mean, I think as an American and as a reporter, I'd sort of learned to be a distant observer and not really join anything. And so the kind of pressure to join and to just learn how to be a part of the culture, whether it was, you know, flipping sausages or standing on the sand with my kids in Nippers, you know, was more confronting than I anticipated. You know, collectivism, I think, is something that comes easily to a lot of Australians, but for a lot of Americans, it feels like peer pressure. And it was something that initially I wanted to resist.
Yep, but then you signed your kids up to an Australian school and suddenly there you were with the apron and the tongs.
Yeah, exactly. I was a complete failure at my first sausage sizzle, I have to say. I was stressed and sweating, and luckily everyone put up with me.
Yeah, well, that's a very Australian thing too, isn't it? It's like, you know, you can't learn how to flip a sausage first time.
Yeah, I mean, just this idea of, well, have a go, have a crack at it, you know, and I think that that is something that, while it feels simple, is actually quite profound and can really lead to, frankly, a better life.
Well, and let's look too at what it was like for you and your wife living in New York, Damien. I understand your wife was having a fantastic time, but it does sound like it was a bit of a mixed bag for you as a family.
Yeah, I mean, I think we realized that we were spending very little time with our children. We were working all of the time. And the way that New York life is sort of set up, you almost subcontract out care of your children. They had lots of activities that they were doing that we never saw them do because we were so busy working. And I think we started to just kind of drift apart a bit. And for me, I feel like I was just kind of in this routine of doing the same things again and again. And it just felt like you were on this kind of hamster wheel without really living a life where you were really deeply engaged with anything besides work and simply trying to pay the bills. And there just wasn't as much of a sort of social fabric, strangely, as we found in Australia. And even when I've lived in other countries, you know, it was different there, obviously. But again, there just wasn't that same expectation of joining and becoming a part of it. We could be expats, whereas in Australia, we were expected and demanded to become, you know, immigrants, part of this place.
And you write too, Damien Cave, about the outsourcing of parenting in Brooklyn where you lived, but also a particular kind of parenting that gave you and your wife pause for thought at times.
Yeah, I mean, we thought we were pretty good at risk, in part because we would go to these meetings. I remember this one meeting for summer camp for my two kids, where these parents were freaking out because the kids were going to be in knee-high water, and they wanted to make sure that there was at least one or two adults per child. And even for us, who were far from being, you know, very aquatic, it just felt kind of crazy. And there was just this expectation that the job of the parent was to remove risk as much as possible and have as much safety as possible. And if you were, you know, educated and had been relatively successful, well, the best thing you could do is just keep your kids as safe as possible. And that was the goal. And I think coming to Australia, I started to question that as, well, wait, why is that better to just, why does perfect safety have to be the goal? And is that really the way we want to live? What do you lose when that's what you're shooting for? And I think Australia opened my mind up a bit to other possibilities.
Yeah, well, I can see why nippers would be confronting if you've got one or two adults per children in other contexts. We're speaking with Damien Cave, who's the New York Times bureau chief in Australia, based in Sydney, and he's got a book out called Into the Rip, How the Australian Way of Risk Made My Family Stronger, Happier and Less American. And there's some really fascinating contentions in there that I hope we'll get a chance to teach. He's out on Life Matters today. Damien, we'll get to nippers in just a tick, but I'm really struck by this story you tell of covering bushfire season in Australia, and at one point you have a flat tyre on a country road, and you write that you were amazed that every single driver who went past during that time you were trying to fix it stopped to try to help you. Is that, are you saying that that wouldn't happen in the States? People would say, sorry, you're on your own. Burned to death.
I think that maybe somebody would stop, but I know for a fact, because I've been on the side of the road in the United States, that not everyone stops. And you know what I found really striking was that uniformity of that to some degree. Like the first guy who drove past had a packed car. He was clearly going somewhere. And that he stopped as soon as he saw us. And then that even though there was somebody already stopped, others felt compelled to check in and make sure we were okay too, was pretty amazing. And then, you know, the whole problem is resolved by this guy pulling this giant trailer of logs, who just hops out and with like 10 words and 5 minutes fixes it for us. And so, you know, it was just like, to me, a sign of the uniformity of this desire to sort of help and a uniformity of this collective approach. You know, there was smoke in the distance. We were perfectly safe, but there was this sense of, hey, listen, there's a risky situation here. We need to make sure that everyone we see is okay. And, you know, it really was meaningful for me.
Well, and I'm wondering too, if that's the difference between being in the city and being in the country, whatever nation you happen to live in, because that is how regional communities survive, isn't it? They have to band together when there's a threat that affects some of them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that that's probably true in more rural communities. And, you know, there's lots of wonderful people in rural communities in the United States and in every country. But I don't know. I mean, I do think that even this sort of myth of how the Australian frontier was kind of settled, it's a group activity in Australian stories. In American stories, it's about the rugged individualist who went alone. And so even in sort of the stories that each country tells about itself, there's a big difference in terms of what's valued and what's appreciated.
Yeah. I mean, I guess when you drill down in both countries, there's that nuance, isn't there, of wealth and disadvantage and race and heritage playing into a lot of the bigger narratives that we've grown up telling ourselves. But it is a fascinating look at Australia through an outsider's perspective, reading your book, Damien. Let's drop into the rip. Your first day at Nippers tryouts, an average day at Bronte, so chest high waves and strong rips. How was that for you coming from, you know, fresh from this New York helicopter parenting context?
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty remarkable. I mean, as soon as we got down to the beach, there were all these kids who, you know, some of whom were barely old enough to tie their own shoes, and they were just being thrown into this massive surf, you know, to swim pretty far out past the break on these boards that looked to me like little tiny narrow logs. And then there were all these parents in orange neon and water safety, and the whole thing was just such a group activity too. I mean, first of all, I was afraid and I was having to sort of learn to deal with that for my own kids. And then I was also trying to just figure out, well, what are they actually trying to learn here? Like, I kind of thought it was just like a sporting activity. It didn't really hit me that this was about actual life saving. And then just the group part of it, that like parents weren't just supposed to stand there and watch or drop them off, that they were also supposed to participate. And my kids were going to have to build trust, not just in me as a parent, but in all these other parents of kids that they barely knew. And so that whole mix of things almost from the start, I just found completely remarkable.
I found it interesting too how you said there was a difference in approach between Australia and America in how you look at proficiency. So, you know, that process of failing and picking yourself up and trying again and maybe being a bit upset about it too. How did that play out for you?
I mean, I just love this idea of proficiency and think that it could and should be a model, not just for adults, but for children, but for societies. I mean, skilled in doing, you know, in the United States, I think it's about winning. And either, if you can't be the absolute best in a lot of things, then you don't do them at all. And so you cut off access to all these wonderful experiences, where in Australia and with Surf Life Saving, this idea of, well, you do it, you don't have to be perfect, but you have to be good enough at it to be competent. And the way we're going to make you proficient is by doing it with others. And so, you know, that sort of combination of proficiency and doing it sort of with a team and with other kinds of volunteers, I just think is a really compelling idea. And there's humility in it, but there's also strength and high expectations for competence and bravery. And I don't know, it's something that I really found to be a really important idea.
It sounds like it was a bumpy ride though for your children, particularly your son Baz at the start. How did you go with that? Was that challenging for you, having to kind of work out how much to push him?
Absolutely. I mean, it was, I think one of the great challenges in parenting is trying to figure out when to just let kids do what they want to do and when to push them past their own comfort zones. And so it was really difficult. I mean, there were plenty of times where, you know, he wanted to quit and I just wanted to let him quit. But I just kind of felt like that wasn't doing what both he needed to do, but also it didn't feel like we would be kind of joining this thing that we had committed to joining. I just didn't want him to learn how to quit. And so he eventually turned it around on me and kind of said, okay, well, if I'm not going to quit, then you have to try it too. And I have to say that was something that I underestimated the value of too, the importance of not just sort of telling our kids what to do, but actually trying to model risk-taking behavior and model pushing ourselves beyond our own boundaries. I think it taught me and my children, you know, a lot more than we expected.
Yeah, the bronze medallion you signed up for. What did you think that would take out of you when you first signed up?
I mean, once again, I mean, this is clearly a part of my problematic personality, because I just had expected that it was going to be fine and totally easy. And hey, who can't swim, you know, a few laps in a pool? I'm a decent swimmer. And it just was a lot harder than I thought. I mean, I failed the first qualifying test. I had to take swim lessons with the same person who taught my son and my daughter how to swim. And then I just had to really work up to appreciating the water. I mean, I think a lot of Australians who are so familiar with the water just take as a given that, oh, everyone must love swimming and appreciate it. And I frankly hated it. And so I had to kind of learn to overcome that pain and that struggle and just not really wanting to do it. And again, this is something that we ask our kids to do all the time. But how often do we do it?
Well, and there's got to be a balance, hasn't there, between the kind of optimism that you showed that, yeah, hey, this is probably going to be fine. I'm sure I can do this. I'm a good swimmer. And the I guess, the more realistic approach of let's work out what the steps are and whether I can grade myself through this process. When you failed the initial swim test, Damien, how did you feel?
Oh, I just felt completely humiliated. And to make it all worse, my son Baz came down there with me because he anticipated witnessing my success and me being sucked into life-saving too. So, you know, it was embarrassing. I was the last person to get out of the pool. You know, I felt, you know, as bad as you would if you were a 12 or 13-year-old kid being made fun of at the schoolyard, you know, and I was in my early 40s. And so it was really hard. And I think, I don't know, it was a feeling that I hadn't felt in a while. In a weird way, it was like returning to childhood for me. And it kind of set me off on that journey of kind of learning how to grow up again.
We've received a really interesting text message, Damien Cave. We're speaking with Damien Cave, who's the New York Times Australian Bureau Chief. He's based in Sydney, and he's been looking very closely at Australian culture compared to what he grew up with in the States. His book's called Into the Rip. And Damien, the text says, after living in Europe for 20 years, returning to Australia was very challenging. We felt the pressure to be Australian. There didn't seem to be room for us to be individuals. We were pressured to join our son in nippers, to be at the beach every day. The pressure to fit into the category of Australian is overwhelming. We are Australian, but we're not like every other Australian. So do you feel that there's some nuance there that perhaps Australia could do a bit better when it comes comes to the individual versus the collective, or that kind of tall poppy syndrome where you do celebrate the achievements of the individual?
I mean, I definitely think there's a lot of room for improvement. And I think sometimes the way Australia's sort of pressure to conform works, it can be used for good and it can be used for ill. You know, there's a point at which it becomes too much. But one of the things that I felt going through this process is that there's actually just not enough explanation along the way. I think a lot of Australians who are demanding that we behave a certain way don't feel the need to explain why or why it's valuable or why it's important. And they just sort of assume that whoever they're pressuring is going to get it. And so the one thing that I would say is I do sometimes wish, and even in my own experience, that people would have said, hey, listen, I know this is going to be scary or this is going to be uncomfortable. This is why we're doing it. Lots of other people who have, you know, limited experience like you can do this too. And, you know, if you don't do it, it's not the end of the world. There's other ways to participate or whatever the case might be. And so I think sometimes Australians don't see the experiences that they're demanding of others in perspective, and that they could do a better job of actually really contemplating what it is that they're trying to do, say, with Nippers, and explaining it to people so that they can get on board, and so that that individualism can be respected, but that also there's a persuasive sort of reason for this. You know, like, peer pressure can be used for good, but it can also be used to just sort of exclude people and put too much pressure on people.
Yeah, that's something a lot of Australians are familiar with. Damien, how did your kids go in the longer term with Nippers and with the kind of broader social adjustments that living in Australia brought?
You know, they both stuck with Nippers for a while. My daughter's still doing it. My son has shifted more towards surfing. But I think what Nippers sort of taught us was this desire to kind of, or this, the value of trying new things and pushing ourselves. And that sort of continued. And, you know, my kids, I think, really love it here. And there are a few things that they've had to get used to that I just think are different. And, you know, things like, I just think that there's more public speaking in schools here. You know, I think there's more of an expectation that you're going to have a crack and you might lose. And, you know, we're going to push you maybe into a sport you haven't done before or a class that you haven't done before. And you're going to need to understand the outdoors to some degree or be able to work with your hands no matter what part of the society you're in. And so those are all things that I think they've had to get used to. But they've really, really loved it. I mean, I think that, you know, Australia is in many ways a model society for children, even in just simple things, you know, like more and more kids walk to school here than they do in a lot of places in the United States or the UK. And there's just, I think, a trust and a faith that while it's diminishing, it's probably not as strong now as it was 20 or 30 years ago, is still really strong and worth recognizing and building on.
I found it really interesting too, Damien, reading the interplay between your personal stories from you and the family and the research that you drew on, things about the growth mindset and the power of persistence, and also how good we are at assessing risk as a species. We're not great, are we?
No, we're terrible. Humans have been terrible at assessing risk over and over again forever. And there's a very, in some ways, simple way to think about it. You know, as I asked Paul Slovak, who's this leading expert in risk for decades, I said, what does this really all add up to, Paul? And he said, you know, it just means, Damien, that we make decisions based on emotions. And so if we go into something afraid, we make a decision based on fear. If we go in overconfident, we make a decision based on overconfidence. No matter how much data there is, no matter how much we know about probability, our first reaction is often based on what we feel. And we get it wrong a lot.
Yep, yep. Anyone who's ever signed up for the bronze medallion, I think, can probably attest to that, as you can. What about the power of persistence? Is that just about saying to kids, look, just keep trying, you'll get there eventually, somewhere?
Yeah, I mean, the persistence piece of it is important. And the thing is, you can't really get to persistence if you don't first do things that are a little scary, right? Like, a lot of what the research shows is pushing yourself into that place where you're feeling a little vulnerable and a little bit challenged. You know, you get better over time. The more you do it, the more confident you are going into the next task. And so that sense of persistence is important to build up in people. And also just to sort of recognize that most of the time, things turn out okay. And so if you spend your life sort of avoiding risk and trying to staying away from it, you're more likely to be suffering from depression. You're more likely to have despair. You're less likely to feel confident when something does confront you that's different. And so the thing that I think is really encouraging about the research when you look at the way risk works is that it's something we can all get better at with practice.
Well, it's really interesting too that you spend quite a bit of time looking at the difference or the way our focus on self-esteem sits next to this idea of mastery. Can you explain that a bit for people who might not know those terms so well?
Yeah, I mean, I think this was especially prevalent in the United States when I was growing up, but there was such an emphasis on this idea of self-esteem and the self-esteem movement, which basically said, if you tell people that they should be feeling good about themselves or they're beautiful or they're smart, then they're going to have enough confidence to go and do things really well. And it turned out that that research basically had it completely backwards, that the idea is that you actually need to do things to build self-esteem. Self-esteem is important, but you actually don't get to a place where you feel good about yourself just by telling yourself or having someone else tell you that you're doing great. You actually have to build toward mastery. You know, it comes from doing, feeling good comes from doing well. Doing well isn't a product of telling yourself you feel good. And I think there's still a long legacy of this sometimes in the way we talk to children and in the way that we as a society sort of organize ourselves. This idea that the self and how we feel is most important. Well, in fact, the feelings need to be secondary. You actually need to do the actions first.
Though you did talk to someone who used to work, I think, with Timbertop, you know, and they were talking about there's just a school run out of Geelong, but in the countryside in Victoria, where kids go to kind of live in the bush for a while. And he was talking about the need to balance the support and the challenge, wasn't he? There's got to be a balance.
Yeah, absolutely. There has to be. I mean, children do best when they feel like they have high expectations and a lot of support. And again, this is the kind of thing that I saw again and again in Nippers, where kids were pushed, you know, beyond where they felt comfortable. But there were tons of other kids and parents in the water with them all saying, hey, listen, you've got this. And to some degree, that's how we need to raise our children, is to set these high expectations, knowing that they might not get it the first time, and remind them that that's okay, and that we're going to be there for them as they move through this process. And that it's probably going to take longer than they think. You know, sometimes the process, whether it's at Timbertop or it's in the ocean, it doesn't happen right away. And that's such an important lesson for kids to learn and for parents to remember too, that it takes a long time to build strength and mastery.
Well, and that really makes me think of our approach to this pandemic. And you make the link in your book between this idea of collective endeavor and doing things that are good for the collective and our approach to natural disasters, including COVID.
Well, it's quite clear that it's breaking down. It's not as strong as it was, you know, say a year ago. But, you know, I also think it depends on how you look at it. You know, I see enormous strength in some of these communities in Western Sydney, whether it's Fairfield or Blacktown, where they went from a very low vaccination rate to vaccination rates that are over 90%. You know, and in interviews that I've done with people out there, you know, they tell me that they've gone door to door, that I know I talked to this guy who's a basketball coach in Blacktown who said he's been hosting question and answer sessions online for the South Sudanese community so that they don't feel hesitant about vaccines. There's people doing food delivery throughout these communities. So when you go in and dig a little deeper, I actually still think there's a ton of solidarity and collectivism that's happening. When you look at the politicians and the political class, that's less so. But I think it's important to make a distinction between the politics and the culture of Australian politics and the culture of Australian people. And I still think that at the people level, there's this desire to help. And the same thing that I read about in the book, which was, I just don't want to be the one that lets everyone down. And that's still very alive in Australia in a way that I think is harder to find in some other places.
Damien Cave, you have covered war zones in Iraq, you've dodged IEDs, you've been at drug busts in Mexico City, and you write that your priorities have changed a bit since you came to Australia. What would you hope for you and your family in the future now?
Well, I think that for us, we've started to learn the importance of connection and connectivity to our community and to each other, and to not simply see ourselves as this autonomous individual that can do whatever we want without thinking of others. I think the most significant thing for us is that we've really started to recognize the power and the importance of playing that role, whether it's volunteering, whether it's with other people in our community, whatever the case may be. And then the second thing I think is to just remember to keep trying new things, you know, to say yes to more things, and that there's hope in fear to some degree and in pain, that when you look at things that are difficult, it doesn't mean that how they are now is how they'll always be. And if we just continue to keep pushing ourselves into the rib, we'll end up happier and more fulfilled and, yes, more connected to other people too. And then the third thing is just to sort of cut ourselves some slack, that perfection is not necessarily where we need to be. Proficiency is actually the model that we should be aiming for.
Continuous improvement, to borrow a truly appalling term from human resources, but yeah, some relevance.
Exactly.
Damien Cave, thank you so much for joining us today, and all the best for your life here in Australia or wherever things take you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Damien Cave, his book's called Into the Rip, How the Australian Way of Risk Made My Family Stronger, Happier, and Less American.